to act today. In other words, in the case of Rwanda, it would have meant sending in troops. Nobody's going to send in troops to Gaza, but what the U.S. could do, as we were discussing, they could stop arming, they could stop funding the plausible genocide, the clear war crimes in Gaza. And so it's just a matter of saying the money and the arms will stop unless the killing and the starvation stops. That's all it would take, and Netanyahu would have to listen. Biden refuses to take that step.
And what do you think he could do at this point to turn this around?
It's as simple as that, Amy. In other words, if he were to say, you know, Netanyahu, I've had it with your game playing. I've had it with your pretending to comply with my concerns. This is it. You know, you've got to really stop bombing civilians. You've got to open up the gates and allow food in. And if that doesn't start today, the arms sales end tomorrow.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And by the way, I want to say that at the time, 1994, Madeleine Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then became Secretary of State. I want to thank Ken Roth, who is former executive director of Human Rights Watch for close to 30 years, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And I want to thank Noel Zahabamwe, who is founder and chair of the African Australian Advocacy Center, speaking to us from Australia, a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek threatens to veto spending on certain water infrastructure projects. Container trucks could be vulnerable to hacking, a new report says. And the lawsuit over public access to Oswego Lake enters a new phase. Can people access the lake from public parks? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek announced the bills passed by the legislature this session that she's considering vetoing. These include a $14 million allocation for water infrastructure projects like new sewers and wastewater treatment, and a $2 million carve-out for a sneaker incubator in Portland's Old Town neighborhood. Kotek says certain water districts and cities didn't give enough information about how the money would be spent. One of those cities is Siletz, which would spend $3 million on a new wastewater treatment plant. Kotek worried some of these projects aren't inherently related to housing, which was her big priority. But Siletz says the treatment plant will expand clean water access to lots that could be developed as soon as next year. The footwear and clothing incubator would pull existing companies into the same space to develop new products, focusing on ones that are environmentally friendly. She'll decide on her final vetoes by April 17th, and until then, she's encouraging cities and organizations to submit more information to convince her not to veto their bill. New federal regulations may have put America's trucking industry at risk of being hacked. That's according to a new paper presented by Colorado State University's cybersecurity researchers at the 2024 Network and Distributed Systems Security Symposium. Eric Galatas has more.
New worker safety regulations meant to log how many hours truckers are on the road may have inadvertently exposed millions of U.S. 18-wheelers to hackers who could take control of entire fleets of vehicles, according to a new Colorado State University paper. Co-author Jake Jepson says it's important to create guardrails as the nation's transportation networks, power grids, water systems, and other critical infrastructure move online.
Each year, those systems that never used to be connected to the internet or have any like wireless connections, they are becoming more and more connected, and that can introduce vulnerabilities.
CSU researchers found the cybersecurity gaps in electronic logging devices, which track a host of data required for inspections. The devices are connected to the vehicle's control systems and are not currently required to carry cybersecurity precautions. In one example, the paper shows how hackers can manipulate trucks wirelessly and force them to pull over. CSU Associate Professor Jeremy Daly says students were able to locate the gaps by reverse engineering one of the devices, which are produced by third-party vendors. He says adding new electronics to trucks that don't go through a typical manufacturer's design process can introduce new vulnerabilities.
When regulators are introducing new requirements, they have to be aware of the cybersecurity implications.
Daly estimates that more than 14 million medium and heavy-duty trucks that form the core of the U.S. shipping sector may have been exposed. He says the paper's findings can help device vendors fix the problem.
The happy ending of this story is that we have worked with the vendor and they have come up with a patch to the problem. And so it's important for the truckers and the people that have these devices to pay attention to those software update recommendations when they come out.
This is Eric Galatas for the Colorado News Connection.
The question of public access to Oswego Lake will be in court again in the coming weeks. Jury selection is underway in Clackamas County this week. In 2012, Lake Oswego City Council voted to ban people from entering the lake from waterfront parks. Since then, the lake is only accessible by people who live on the lake and city residents who can access a seasonal swim park. The city was sued over this ban based on an Oregon law that says all waterways that could be navigated by a boat are public and must be accessible from public land. An earlier phase of the trial went in the plaintiff's favor, establishing that the waters are subject to public trust doctrine, meaning the public must have access. This new phase of the trial will examine the city law that bans people from accessing the water from the city's public parks on the lake. The city says their restrictions should be allowed, saying that the public, quote, has visual access to the lake. The trial is scheduled to last 2 weeks. Following the alleged torture and killing of a Wyoming wolf documented on social media, a lawsuit has been filed challenging the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over its recent decision to deny federal protection for western wolves under the Endangered Species Act. New Mexico has extra penalties for shooting a wolf, but Wyoming and several other nearby states allow year-round killing. Roz Brown has more from Albuquerque.
A lawsuit over a federal agency's decision not to boost wolf protections in New Mexico and other western states has been filed days after video surfaced showing the torture of a captured wolf. According to accounts, a Wyoming man ran the wolf down with a snowmobile in late February, disabling it. He then took it to a local bar and posed for photos before shooting it. Eric Mulvar with the Western Watersheds Project says federal protections under the Endangered Species Act are essential because there are still those who don't respect wildlife.
That's why wolves were driven extinct in the first place, is because these types of people were the ones who controlled the public policy discussion throughout much of the 20th century when wolves were driven extinct.
In early February, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service declined to restore protections for gray wolves in western states. The agency said it concluded the animals weren't in danger of extinction under the Endangered Species Act. The lawsuit was filed by the Western Environmental Law Center on behalf of Western Watersheds and a coalition of 9 other conservation groups. Mulvar believes the federal agency's decision not to redesignate western wolves as endangered was profoundly misguided. He says some states, such as New Mexico and Colorado, have adopted extra penalties for killing wolves, but the Endangered Species Act lets hunters in other states off the hook if they claim it was a case of mistaken identity.
But there were special loopholes for Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, and also parts of Oregon, Washington, and Utah. So it does beg the question of how often this is happening quietly and under the radar.
In Wyoming, wolves and coyotes, which are considered predators, aren't eligible for protections under the state's animal cruelty statute. To date, the only penalty inflicted on the person shown on social media tormenting the wolf was a $250 fine by the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Clackamas County is sending out around $7 million to cities for their projects related to the homelessness crisis. This includes things like a food pantry in Gladstone, rental assistance in Milwaukee, and a community service officer in Sandy. It's through a grants program. 20 will go out to the cities across the county. The funds come from the Metro Supportive Housing Measure, which has brought in about $100 million more dollars than initially predicted. The different metro counties manage their money differently. Multnomah County uses the Joint Office of Homeless Services to spread the funding around, but they've been criticized by smaller East County cities like Fairview, Troutdale, and Wood Village, who feel they don't get enough attention or enough funding. Recently, the Joint Office hired an East County Homeless Service liaison, which they hope will improve services and coordinate with the Joint Office. The key to a climate-friendly home might be a new breaker box. Before people start swapping their old fossil fuel-powered appliances for clean electric versions, they'll need to install a 200-amp electrical panel. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many people are replacing their old fossil fuel-powered furnaces and gas stoves with new electric heat pumps and induction stoves. But some hit a snag when they find out that their home's electrical panel, or breaker box, cannot handle all the extra electricity they'll need.
That's when you realize, oh, I need a little more juice.
Eric Fowler is with the nonprofit Fresh Energy, which advocates for clean energy in Minnesota.
We want folks to be able to have the option to even consider those electric alternatives, but you can't do that if you're already hitting up against the maximum amount of electricity that your panel can supply.
He recommends upgrading to a 200-amp panel before going fully electric.
You might even be okay with less, but you're really probably good for an all-electric home with 200 amps.
You might also need to have the wires leading into your home upgraded, so your utility company can provide you with enough power. These improvements can be expensive, but federal tax credits can now help people afford to upgrade their electrical panels when they install a heat pump or other qualified electric appliance. So upgrading to an all-electric and less polluting home is now easier than ever.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Maine votes in support of a national popular vote. Nebraska rejects a winner-take-all system for electoral college votes. And former President Trump says abortion rights should be left to the states. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think everyone understands the idea of one person, one vote, and this is the time for us to adopt that for voting for our President of the United States.
State Representative Arthur Bell voted for Maine to join a national popular vote compact. 16 blue states and Washington, D.C. have moved toward awarding their electoral college votes to the nation's popular winner. Critics say that would weaken smaller states. Maine's governor hasn't said if she'll sign the bill. An effort to award Nebraska's 5 electoral votes winner-take-all failed last week, but supporters say they'll try again during this legislative session. Nebraska, like Maine, awards delegates by congressional district and gave President Joe Biden a vote from the one including Omaha. Democratic State Senator Megan Hunt says former President Donald Trump is pressuring lawmakers.
Obviously wants this electoral vote because he's so scared he can't win the presidency without it. He's so scared that the same thing will happen that happened in the last presidential election. He'll lose.
Meanwhile, Trump announced abortion rights should be decided by the states, with rape, incest, and life of the mother exceptions.
And whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people.
Trump is declining to back a national ban and is trading attacks with supporters over it. A New York appeals judge has rejected another Trump request to delay and move his first criminal trial. Jury selection starts in a week on charges the former president paid hush money to a porn star and illegally hid the payments. President Biden chose the battleground of Wisconsin to announce new student loan debt relief for up to 25 million borrowers. He says this will especially help the many who owe more than they borrowed due to excessive interest.
I will never stop to deliver student debt relief on hardworking Americans, and it's only in the interest of America that we do it. And again, it's for the good of our economy.
This was Biden's second recent trip to Wisconsin, where 50,000 Democrats voted uncommitted in the primary in protest of his handling of Gaza. The Arkansas Supreme Court says voting machines do comply with state law. Clint Lancaster with Arkansas Voter Integrity Initiative had argued the voters can't verify their ballots because they can't read the barcodes.
We go to great lengths to make our currency secure. All right, you have special paper holograms, all this stuff. But you can go get a ballot down at like FedEx, mark it up and send it in.
The challenge was one of many nationally after Trump claimed without evidence the machines were rigged against him in 2020. Studies show hand counting ballots is less accurate due to human error. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Well,
you're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview on the potential ban of TikTok. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Big Picture Science Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 65. Today in history, in 1947, the journey of reconciliation begins. It was the first interracial freedom ride through the Upper South in violation of Jim Crow laws. The riders wanted enforcement of the United States Supreme Court's 1946 Irene Morgan decision that banned racial segregation in interstate travel. The quote of the day is from American satirist Tom Lehrer, who said, quote, "I'm sure we all agree that we ought to love one another, and I know there are people in the world who do not love their fellow human beings, and I hate people like that." Work is due to begin on building a monument to children killed at a Rapid City, South Dakota Indian boarding school. The goal is for the memorial to be constructed by Native American Day in October. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Construction on a memorial to honor the nearly 50 documented children who died at a Rapid City Indian boarding school starts soon. Officials say crews will finish the memorial by Native American Day in October. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
After World War II, the city of Rapid City, through a congressional authorization, annexed 1,200 acres of land in West Rapid City. The move displaced Natives living near the former Sioux Sanatorium. Native Americans were then moved to what's considered North Rapid. A new memorial will pay homage to that displacement, as well as honor 50 children believed to have died while the facility was a boarding school.
The intention is really to build empathy and understanding in our community.
That's Amy Sazu, executive director of the Remembering the Children Memorial.
To help people understand their community members and neighbors a little bit better, understand race relations in our community a little bit better, see some of the symptoms of historical trauma, and understand that, you know, understand those that are still suffering from the impacts of historical trauma a little bit better.
The memorial will be built on tribal trust land belonging to the Rosebud, Oglala, and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes. Once construction is complete, the next phase of the memorial will take shape, which is art installation. Sazu, who is Lakota, says the memorial will look like a public art space.
The spirit of different parts of the story have to be present, and there's no better way than to do that than through art.
The memorial will also feature a sculpture by Indigenous artists. The sculpture will likely be installed by spring of 2025. I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Tribes across the country observed Monday's solar eclipse in various ways or took time to reflect during its occurrence. Tribes have different beliefs and stories regarding solar eclipses, with cultural narratives that vary. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma held a solar eclipse viewing party. One of Cherokee Nation's stories focuses on a frog. As educator, storyteller, and Cherokee Nation national treasure, Robert Lewis explains, the story originates around the 1800s. Lewis says Cherokee people gathered and noticed a darkness across the landscape. They noticed the sun being covered, a giant frog swallowing the sun, so they decided to scare it away. Here's part of the story Lewis shared on social media.
They decided they're going to try to scare it away. So the medicine people said, we need to frighten it away. So they pulled out their guns and firearms and began to shoot them in the air. They began to sit there, take pots and pans, and began to bang on them and scream and yell and do whatever kind of noise they could make to frighten the frog away. Eventually, the sun came back, the mouth let go, and the frog disappeared. That's basically the story that we got. It's been passed down. Storyteller is a storyteller. I can embellish it. You can have other aspects of the creature showing up. This has been going for days trying to figure out what's going on. For the most part, the basic story talks about the fact that the frog was coming to swallow the sun, and we scared it away.
Lewis says during an eclipse, Cherokee people will often go out and try and frighten the frog away. The Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma also held activities and events across Choctaw country to observe and educate. A Choctaw story involves a black squirrel who nibbled the sun as Choctaw people noticed it getting darker, so they scared the squirrel away. The Navajo Nation, located in the Four Corners region, views the eclipse as a sacred time, traditionally staying indoors, praying, and reflecting. The Navajo Nation kept the executive branch open as well as essential services, including police and hospitals. The solar eclipse crossed North America, where people gathered at various locations, especially in the path of totality, from Mexico across the United States, from Texas to Maine, and Canada's Atlantic coast. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Amid a nationwide decline in college enrollment, schools and policymakers are being urged to prioritize student concerns, especially in conservative states. Findings from a new Gallup poll show college students want to be able to talk about different topics and viewpoints rather than limiting what professors can teach. Indianapolis-based Lumina Foundation released the poll jointly with Gallup. The foundation's Courtney Brown says across various demographics, age groups, genders, and political affiliations, there are some common themes.
What we found across the board is that students want to attend an institution in a state that has more restrictive policies regarding guns on campuses, less restrictive policies on reproductive rights, and teaching certain viewpoints or divisive topics.
Brown says it's important for schools to create environments that prioritize safety, inclusivity, and academic freedoms. In the poll, 76% of respondents said state legislation that restricts discussion of divisive topics would be a factor in their choice of where to enroll. The poll focused on people who started their college journeys and didn't graduate, but are considering going back to school. A majority said their top priorities are cost, flexibility, and quality of education. But Brown says they're also weighing issues like guns on campus, reproductive health care, and states' restrictions on curriculum to ensure they feel comfortable with their college of choice.
Many students don't get the opportunity to leave their state. If their states have laws and policies that are counter to what the student wants, this can create some problems. Either the student isn't going to attend, or they're going to feel very uncomfortable attending, and they may not stay.
About three quarters of Asian respondents and just over half of Black respondents polled said that decision will influence where they decide to get their degree. This weekend marked 6 months of Israel's war on Gaza. As one commentator notes, by providing offensive weapons to Israel that are being used in ways that violate international and U.S. laws, the U.S. is complicit in Israel's war crimes. Suspending such arms deliveries may be the only way to stop the violations and improve prospects for a permanent ceasefire. We now go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The Biden administration continues to act contrary to logic, law, and humane values in response to Israel's war policies. Despite overwhelming evidence of Israel's war crimes and acts that constitute genocide, the administration plies the right-wing Israeli government with more weapons. The latest arms package being prepared by the administration will reportedly be the largest since the October 7 Hamas attack. Valued at around $18 billion, it will include 50 F-15 fighter jets and precision-guided munitions kits. While delivery of the jets will not take place for about 5 years, it sends an utterly wrong signal. Besides, the administration has already approved immediately sending more 2,500-pound bombs. Many critics, including some within the administration itself and in Democratic congressional circles, have pointed with alarm to the obvious contradiction in U.S. policy between supporting negotiations on a ceasefire and hostage release on the one hand, and continuing to ship non-defensive weapons to Israel on the other. The contradiction applies not just to the immediate situation in Israel, but also to overall U.S. policy on the abuse of military aid under NSM National Security Memorandum 20, which specifies that arms recipients must adhere to international and American law. Israel, while giving assurances about its use of U.S. weapons, has violated U.S. policy guidelines in numerous ways. For instance, bombing hospitals and other civilian targets with U.S. bombs, and using U.S.-supplied white phosphorus munitions in densely populated areas of Gaza. Such violations make the U.S. complicit in Israel's war crimes and genocide, which Oxfam and Human Rights Watch documented in a joint letter submitted to the administration March 13. Just recently, the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Rights condemned Israel's genocide, her word, in Gaza and proposed an arms embargo on Israel. More and more Democrats are lining up behind the idea of some kind of arms transfer limitation, defying Biden's effort to assuage them by abstaining on the latest UN vote on a ceasefire and criticizing Israel's obstruction of humanitarian aid for Gaza. But suspending arms aid to Israel, which can range from all arms to bombs alone, seems off the table. It might be argued that the president is in an impossible bind during an election year. No policy can satisfy both pro- and anti-Israel groups. But on balance, it might be said, the political costs for Biden are probably greater if he openly and consistently confronts Israel than if he straddles the fence as he's doing now. The Trump factor, as well as traditional pro-Israel forces in Congress and lobbies, all exert considerable influence. Biden and his advisors evidently have concluded that he will simply have to weather the defections of some Democratic Congress members and heat from Arab Americans. What he should give greater weight, however, is to the extraordinary human costs of this war, which will only grow with each passing day in which his administration fails to move the Netanyahu government to a settlement. I don't doubt Biden's sincerity when he says he feels the pain of Arab Americans, says Israel has not done enough to reduce civilian casualties in Gaza, and says he is outraged and heartbroken over the deaths of the 7 World Central Kitchen aid workers. Nor do I underestimate Biden's anger with Netanyahu when they spoke April 4. The president called the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza unacceptable, demanded a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers, said an immediate ceasefire is essential, and made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. All that is well and good as far as it goes, but demands and vague warnings probably won't go far enough. For as we have seen time and again, the Netanyahu government has defied U.S. wishes. If the Biden administration wants to be taken seriously, it must use the leverage at its disposal and make clear to Israel that failure to comply will lead to a stop in delivery at a minimum of non-defensive weapons. Stopping arms transfers is the key to compelling a policy change in Tel Aviv and helping reduce civilian casualties. Otherwise, U.S. policy will continue to be perceived as helping prolong the war and contributing to the horrific humanitarian crisis in Gaza. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 9, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow. The producer is Althea Billings. and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Galatas, Roz Brown, Catherine Carley, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kbu.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Wojcner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. There's been some talk that the U.S. may end up banning TikTok. The Associated Press reports that former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is working on putting together an investment group to buy the short-form video hosting service. Some commentators have said that the targeting of TikTok is actually about Israel. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with content creator James Rewald, who has more than 400,000 followers on TikTok.
You've looked into the TikTok situation, and you think there's something not being revealed there in the mainstream media, it sounds like, that they're talking about a ban or they're talking about cracking down, but you say it has something to do with Israel and Gaza. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, I guess the calls for banning TikTok obviously date back. There was that short stint during the Trump administration, but it's always been like a thorn on the U.S.'s side. But I think that's been, brought back into the fold, especially